In Vancouver, I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca.
Walt Whitman is arguably America's greatest poet, and his final years provide a basis for a new novel from the author and poet George Fetherling. Walt Whitman's Secret is a reimagining of Whitman's final years. The author of Leaves of Grass is an ill man whose admirers view him as not only a venerated writer, but some sort of mystic. Whitman struggles with some personal secrets and demons, and in this book we also look at ideas of nationalism, identity, and celebrity. George Fetherling joins me from here in Vancouver to talk about this book and more. We'll talk about his own writing and whether he thinks Whitman is relevant to today. Walt Whitman's Secret is published by Random House. It has already been described as an extraordinary achievement and a resonant, shimmering work. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, George Fetherling. Good morning, Mr. Fetherling.
Hello, John.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, I just realized ever since the book hit my desk a couple months ago now, that it's possible to go through life, I'm 28, without ever encountering Whitman. So not knowing anything about him, not having read the biographies that you have had read, is your book a good introduction to who Whitman is?
I suppose it is. It's not absolutely necessary. In fact, it's not in the least necessary to have any pre-knowledge of Whitman in order to enjoy the book. I knew him because I'm a poet and I'm a literary fellow, and he is always revered as the greatest American poet, certainly of the 19th century, if not of all time, and as the fellow who was sort of the last of the Romantics and the very first of the Modernists. If you were to make an analogy to another medium, he was the Charlie Chaplin of poetry, you know. He was the groundbreaker.
Now, you obviously, you've read his work, you admire the work, the person you don't, right?
Well, I'm of more than one, but fewer than three minds about Walt Whitman as a person. He had many fine qualities. He was a racist, and he was virtually one of the fathers of Americanism of the worst, most patriotic, and most destructive kind. You know, he was a type that was perhaps more rare in those days. Then in a subsequent age, he was a gay Republican. And I admire the bravery of his gayness at a time when, for most of his life, you know, sodomy was a capital offense. I don't admire his proselytizing in extreme ways that you might expect to hear today on the Fox News Network. But to take an example, I mean, he dated his poems and his letters and his experiences not according to the Christian calendar. He dated them according to how many years had elapsed after the Declaration of Independence, or perhaps it was the Constitution, but he would date things in the 73rd year of these states, and these states would be uppercase, you know. Mm-hmm. He was extreme, even for the rough and ready Americanism of his time, although he had many fine qualities. I came to be interested in him. I mean, I knew him as a schoolboy, you know, because he's in anthologies and literary anthologies and things, but I became interested enough in him to write this book because of the fact that in his lifetime he had quite a big reputation, or I should say reputations, because he had a slightly different one in each country. take an example, in the United States, he was, as I described him, you know, the patriotic poet.
Right.
In Germany, he was seen improbably as a serious intellectual, as well as a creative writer. In Britain, he was viewed in a divided way according to class. People in London, the literary Johnnies in London, who were sitting in their clubs in Mayfair and in Pall Mall, saw him as a fellow who was brave in his writing about homoerotic matters. In the north of England, in Yorkshire and in Lancashire and so on, he was seen as a champion of the working class, completely the opposite from the London view. In France, he was viewed as a quintessential American type to be cherished. He was viewed that way by the great grandfathers of those who now hold the same opinion about Jerry Lewis. And in Canada, strangest of all, he was considered to be a mystic and a prophet. He himself did not believe in the occult and did not believe that he had the power of prophecy, but there sprang up around him in Canada a view that he was, how shall I say, his first biographer was a Canadian whose name was Dr. Morris Buck, who was a pioneer Canadian psychiatrist and the head of the Insane Asylum in London, Ontario, who published a very famous book arguing that there are in history a few individuals whose hearts and minds are so advanced as to move the process of evolution forward. And he cited in his book Walt Whitman, Jesus, the Buddha, the Prophet Muhammad, and St. Paul. He was a crackpot, you know.
Yeah. The book goes into the relationship between Whitman and Canada, right? And you told Charlie Demers in the Georgia Strait in that profile that he did of you that this is a profoundly Canadian book.
I believe it is because it concentrates on the relationship between Whitman and all the Canadians, and there were many, many who completely misunderstood him. And it speaks to how the two cultures are bound to misunderstand each other despite, you know, all the similarities of culture and language. All across Canada, there used to be Walt Whitman societies and study groups. And a great many Canadians played an important role in his life. I mean, one was Dr. Buck, whom I already mentioned, but his physician in the latter part of his life was no less, you know, than Sir William Osler of McGill, easily the most famous doctor of the 19th century, and so on, all the way down to sort of the neighborhood level. And he had a great and surprisingly long-lived influence on Canadian culture, on, say, for instance, the Group of Seven. And if you think of the alleged mysticism of Walt and the mystical paintings of Lauren Harris, I mean, you can see that very clearly. And it persisted down through the death of Emily Carr, you know, who lived until the end of the Second World War, you know. So So there was a span of about 50 years in which Whitman, of all people on the planet Earth, seemed to be, if not central, importantly tangential in Canadian culture. It ought to be said that he only visited Canada once in 1880 in London, Ontario, and he was conflicted about the country. He claimed to love the physical Canada. He was fond of the Canada that he saw from the window of the train as he passed through Ontario. He knew nothing at all about Canadian society or Canadian culture, and he so despised all of the British Empire and its ministers and everything it stood for that he was one of those Americans who never quite lost the idea that the United States should annex Canada.
In the book, I'm trying to find it in my notes here, the page number it appears on, you discuss Vancouver, and just offhand sort of comment that it's a town too new to have a history, only opinions. Is that something that Whitman would have thought of, or is that trouble?
I don't know if he knew of Vancouver, but he had a...
Or is that you?
No. He had a series of love affairs, and the most famous one and a transformative one is at the heart of the novel, and that's his relationship to Pete Doyle, who was an Irish immigrant and a Confederate deserter during the Civil War, who was hiding out in the enemy capital in Washington. And his great love before that was a man who was a Canadian who'd gone to the United States to be an omnibus driver, and who went back to Canada in the fullness of time, to Eastern Canada, or to Central Canada, and then at the end of his life decided to move to Vancouver. And indeed, Vancouver in the late 19th century, I mean, was, you know, a little colonial town. I mean, we both know that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A key episode in the book is indeed in Walt's life. It was this long relationship with Pete Doyle. Here's how it went. As a gay man, Whitman was very specific in his tastes. He was fond of much younger fellows in the early 20s or even in their teens who were working class, often immigrants, and a bit rough around the edges, rough trade, as we might say today. All of whom, though, were employed in what we would call the transport sector. He was crazy for stagecoach drivers and for stagehands and for stevedores, bus drivers, and Gandhi dancers on the railway who pounded in the spikes with those funny hammers and so on. And I think this was because as he grew up on the eastern shore of Long Island in New York, right on the Atlantic Ocean, it must have seemed to him growing up as though all transportation automatically was going west. And the west to him, you know, symbolized all those abstractions that the Americans are so fond of, you know, liberty and limitless freedom and all that sort of thing. And Walt, during the American Civil War, in his finest hour, acted as a volunteer nurse in the hospitals in Washington, D.C. He went there to try to find his brother, a Union soldier who had been wounded, and he stayed to nurse in the hospitals. And the casualties in the war were so great that the population of Washington, if you figured in the wounded, actually doubled in a three-month period. And the government was seconding buildings as quickly as they could, and at one point, as hard as this is to believe, had to put wounded on stretchers in in the aisles of the House of Representatives. They had run out of room. Obviously not for long, as that was a bit of a PR disaster for the Lincoln government. And smack in the middle of this was Walt, who acquired a little job that was not too taxing in the bureaucracy as a copyist, you know, copied out the documents. And he spent every cent that he had or could borrow in order to try to help the poor wounded, the wounded of the North and the South. And he would go to these hospitals, and he would hand out to the wounded all sorts of things that you would expect the government to have provided, you know, fresh fruit and postage stamps and clean underwear and that sort of thing. And he did very, very good service. He read letters from home for those who did not know how to read or had been blinded in battle, and he wrote letters for those who did not know how to write or perhaps had lost their hands. And if he came in the morning and there was a vacancy where he was expecting to find a kid he knew, it was he and not the army who had to sit down and write the letter to the family. And he did that for 4 years, and he earned his place in heaven. On a particular night in 1864, he was going home for the evening. He had to catch the last horse-drawn streetcar up Pennsylvania Avenue to get back to his rooming house. And it was a snowy night. He had stolen an army blanket and had wrapped it around his overcoat. And the horse came clopping along, and he got in. He paid his fare of 2 cents. He was the only passenger, and he looked at the kid who was the conductor, who was the fare taker, and also the person who had the reins to the horse. And their two sets of eyes met, and it was obvious at that moment that it was the great love of their lives. And the plot of the novel is involved with this, with its relationship and its breakdown and what it meant in a larger political sphere, you know?
Now Pete, in the novel, he has this connection to Booth, right? John Wilkes Booth.
Here I leave the historical record and kind of, you know.
Okay, so this is because
my imagination. Yeah, but yeah.
A week after the Charlie Demers piece appeared in the Strait, there was a letter from someone who takes exception to what you've done.
There's always a letter from some crackpot who doesn't understand literature. I don't think.
Yeah. So you do leave history, as you just said. Do you think it tarnishes, because that's what the person who wrote into the Strait says, that it tarnishes Whitman's name?
I assume that person is not an experienced reader and does not understand how fiction and how literature work. You know, I mean, the great advantage of a novel that has an historical setting is that it allows the reader to get beyond the stuff that a factual biographer is not allowed to speculate on. I mean, you get to hear private conversations as they probably were, and you get to see the action as it took place behind closed doors, you know? And that's why people have an interest in this kind of literary fiction, and it's why novelists continue to write them. You know, it's a way to weep out of, out of the library and out of the concept of research into literary imagination.
I read online about how you wrote this book, and it just seems like it was arduous, was it?
I always have wanted to be the kind of writer who has a complete and perfectly neat outline in every detail, and who then just has to sit down at the keyboard and compose all the sentences.
Right, right.
Unfortunately, I'm the kind of writer who writes the way he cooks. Every pot and pan is filthy, and the kitchen is filled with black acrid smoke, and the smoke alarm is going off. You know, but in the end, often turns out all right. You know?
Do you know any writers who actually write like that, who write with a neat outline and, you know, a pretty clean desk, if you will?
I do. I really think that may be the more common personality type, actually, yeah. And I always have admired them, but my things are always a mess. You know, I go through, I believe in this case, it was 6 or 7 drafts, and I wrote the first one with a fountain pen on my kitchen table in the West End, and it kind of grew from there. But as late as version number 5, I was throwing whole characters overboard and making up new ones, and, you know, it's a messy procedure as I do it, I'm afraid.
I was curious, what kind of fountain pen did you use?
It's a Waterman, a gold-tipped fountain pen, as it seems to give me the best flow, you know.
I've only started using fountain pens in recent years, and in the last, I guess, year or so. And it's just I'm sort of getting used to it. I always used to use roller balls.
Always remember the line of Woody Guthrie: "Some people rob you with a 6-gun, and some use a fountain pen."
You're working on another novel now?
I am. I'm just at the beginning of it, and. All I know about it for sure is that it's called The Carpenter from Montreal. If I'd read a novel that had that title, and I hope you would too.
Yeah.
And it's a sort of a novel of the age of bootlegging in Montreal and in the United States in the Duplessis years, you know, in the early part of the Duplessis years. Here's how inefficiently I work. All I've written so far is about a person who I think is going to be a minor character, who was a teenager in the 1920s, and her diary is like the diary of teenage girls. She's interested in movies and in boys and in snappy comments about her girlfriends at school and that sort of thing. And I have sat down and written her diary from 1929 to 1932. I don't know how much of it is going to end up in the final novel. All I know for sure is that she's going to become a gun moll as she grows up.
That's every day for those years?
Yep.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah. Now, I've lived in Vancouver my whole life, and I've never gone to the Sylvia.
Oh, I've never gone to the Sylvia Hotel. Well, the two of us should have a drink there sometime.
Yeah, it's a place that I have to go to, is it?
Or is there I see my patients, I change their dressings, that sort of thing, you know.
Yeah. Charlie Demers, I keep referring to that piece that he wrote on you in the Street. He talks at the end of it about how your friends in the canlit world are hoping that this is your breakout book. Now, you've written a number of books already. Do you think like that?
I don't think like that, but it has had the best reviews I've had in the 40-some years I've been publishing books.
Yeah.
It has spoken to some people, to different audiences. I mean, it's a serious novel. It's a novel of ideas, and yet the story rips right along, and I think that appeals, you know, to one audience. And it has maybe a few other things to recommend it. I'm still a little too close to the thing to be able to have a clear perspective on it, but it appears to be doing well, and the reviews have been great, and I'm going to be reading from it at the Vancouver Festival on Granville Island in the autumn, and I've done a lot of promotion already, and done stuff in the Globe and Mail and the National Post, and so on and so on and so on. You know, so it's I think it's going well, and it's already been decided that the paperback is going to come out. Let me see, next April, I think it is.
Right.
And so that's going pretty well. I'm not a terribly materially successful writer, to say the least. But this has been good for me, at least in terms of recognition, you know, from my colleagues and peers.
As someone who has written so much already, with this book coming out, is it enough that you get good reviews, or would you like this to sell a lot?
Well, I have had some books that have been in print for 15 or even for 30 years.
Right.
In one case, but this is not a way to make money. I mean, that's a mistaken understanding of what the life of a Canadian writer is like. You know, I always like to say it's a very good life, but it's not much of a living.
Mm-hmm. George, it's been such a great pleasure to talk to you. I've long admired your writing.
How kind of you to say.
I used to love that column you used to do in The Sun on books every week.
Oh, yeah. I did that for 5 or 6 years, yeah.
Yeah. Continued good luck with this book.
I appreciate your kind words. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. The book is called Walt Whitman's Secret. It's published by Random House. Its author, George Featherling, on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plato.